The date is June 21st, 1991, and we're watching The Rocketeer. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Hello and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me, as always, is the Peavy to my Cliffs Accord.
Hello, I'm Colin Stewart.
And this week, we are celebrating the 30th anniversary month of this film and brought back someone who, I dare say, is obsessed with this movie. If you check out his podcast, you'll see a number of episodes dedicated to exploring this character. A man who has been on our show before, although it's been a minute. Author and host of the 13th Hour podcast, please welcome back Joshua Blum.
Oh yeah, hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, we're excited. Like I said, it's been a minute since we've talked to you. Now, you've recently celebrated your 300th episode, and it started off as a podcast that was you reading your book, and lately you've really evolved into watching the new Rocketeer cartoon. What is it about the Rocketeer, the original movie, the cartoon? What is it about this character that you love so much?
Well, I always liked it from the time I saw it as a kid. And I think there's something about the film. It's a very, it's not a complicated story in many ways. I mean, it's a sort of a simple story.
It's a MacGuffin story. That's what I think about. Yeah, it's not a superhero movie like you see these days. It's a MacGuffin. Everything is all about finding the jetpack.
And I think I like the idea of, I've always liked the idea of flying. I mean, flying itself is like, I'm not a pilot or anything like that, but I think, you know, you can fly in your mind totally unfettered by the constraints of reality. And I think that idea appealed to me as a kid. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I think I really liked the film at the time. And then, you know, when I was going about writing various things, you know, the books and stuff that I've written, mm-hmm. flying made a huge part of it. And this is one of the movies that inspired the writing of the books that I wrote, like the 13th Hour and stuff like that. There's flying imagery and stuff like that.
Yeah. Your main character in the 13th Hour, he has some sort of like silver surfer type contraption that he flies around on, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, I really liked the, and this is when I first saw the film, I was probably like 11 or something like that. It was like our family splurged and we got like the Disney Channel for a short period of time.
Okay.
And, yeah. Like, it was like, so I missed it in the theaters. I mean, we didn't really go to the movies, but they had a quote unquote world premiere on television. And it was sort of a big deal at the time because like there was going to be no commercials and you could watch this movie. It was like a year later after the movie had actually came out. So it was actually 1992.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird to think about, and they actually edited it for TV. So there's not a whole lot of profanity in the movie. It was like, very mild, but they actually edited out a few things. And so the copy that I saw, which I still actually have, I still kind of remember some of the lines the way they were kind of censored in some ways because they're actually different. I saw that copy so many times.
Yeah.
But anyway, I remember really liking it and I would watch it kind of again and again and again, you know, over the years. And then recently I learned that they were going to come out with a cartoon.
Yeah.
Which was aimed at a much younger crowd. And I thought, well, that's different from what I expected, but hey, you know, I can introduce it to my kids.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So, you know, my kids, they'll like look at the comic books and things like that. But this was a much more kind of approachable and kind of understandable kind of thing for them to get into.
Yeah.
Than I think the movie was. And so I think it's a kind of a nice introduction for kids to things like period stuff, like the 1930s.
I haven't actually seen the cartoon. So the cartoon does take place in the 1930s then as well?
No, the original, you know, obviously the original does, but the cartoon is set in the modern day, but it does have throwbacks to that time period. Like there'll be flashbacks and things like that too.
Okay.
And you know, kind of through that, we've talked about a bunch of different things. Like, you know, they'll talk about, of course, aviation, but also about, you know, some famous pilots, you know, what airplanes, you know, used to look like and what they, mm-hmm. you know, how people would fly. There's an ode to, kind of like a homage to a famous female aviator Bessie Coleman, who is like Native American and black, and one of the first female pilots, you know, of color to get her license. Oh, she had to go overseas to do it. Couldn't do it in the States, but but there's like a character in the series that is like an homage to her. And so there's like the neat little things to kind of like talk about with your kids. Mm-hmm. That you don't have to know to appreciate, but it's just kind of like a nice element of history, which is one of the things that they really did. And I think in The Rocketeer is the creator of the comic book, Dave Stevens, was a huge fan of the 1930s. And he threw in so many details about it that you can almost like do an entire course, you know, sort of a history course, learning about all these different things if you wanted to. You don't need to. Yeah. But you almost could.
Yeah, and some of them are so subtle. Like, yeah. it's even like the part where, like, Cliff goes down on the model of the spruce roof, spruce goose, and yeah. Howard Hughes goes, huh, it does fly. You know, like, because famously, the spruce group, I'm having trouble with that one. The spruce goose is something that everyone thought would be too heavy to fly.
Sure.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think there was things like that. I think I liked the character of Cliff. He's a little bit more of a hothead in the comic books.
Okay,
but I liked him in the movies. Movie. There's a little bit of he comes back a little bit in the cartoon.
Okay,
but I liked him in the movie because he was just kind of an ordinary guy and a little bit of kind of hapless, and he just kind of stumbling along, and he was very relatable.
Yeah.
To him, just kind of like, literally kind of like flying by the seat of his pants, you know, through the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, some other films, the hero is very kind of overconfident and, you know, just seems to have things all together. Whereas this guy, you know, he seemed like someone who he finds a rocket pack. He's just trying to get through the day, and things just don't go his way. And I always thought made it at least possible for you to kind of think about the world as something that can be, you know, it's flawed, but it can be better, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, so this week we are looking back at June 1991, when the movies and theaters were Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Kickboxer 2, City Slickers, and of course, our movie for today, The Rocketeer, which earned $46.7 million on a $40 million budget. Not a huge moneymaker, unfortunately.
And as always, we will be blasting off with spoilers, so if you don't want this movie to be spoiled for you, please hit pause, come back, and press play, and then hear what we have to say.
The tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, 3 years before the United States declares war, Cliff Secord leads America's first battle against the Nazis.
I honestly did not even pick up on that until just now.
It's a pretty thorough tagline, but it may not be the best description, so let's go to Colin and do a 60-second synopsis.
Had a really tough time with this one, but gave it my best shot, so here we go.
Okay.
It's 1938 Los Angeles, California. After his brand new plane gets caught in the crossfire of the FBI and some local gangsters, stunt pilot Cliff Secord finds a jetpack hidden by one of the gangsters in an old biplane. When Cliff jumps, nay, rockets, into action to save his friend from crashing a plane during a local air show, the Rocketeer is born. But little does he know there's a lot of people after that jetpack, and now Howard Hughes and the FBI are on his trail. Will Cliff be able to hold on to the jetpack long enough to save his best girl, Jenny, from Hollywood leading man slash Nazi spy Neville Sinclair, who also has designs on using the jetpack to help advance Hitler's plans for global domination? Let's find out on another episode of I Used to Like This One.
Very nice.
Thanks.
Right on, yes. Well, so we've heard all about Josh's love for The Rocketeer, Colin. What about you? Do you have a history with The Rocketeer?
Do I have a history with The Rocketeer? I remember my mom buying me this movie when it came out on VHS.
Well, was it in a clamshell?
It was. It was probably a few years after it came out on VHS.
Okay.
Actually, I don't know if it was in a clamshell. I think it might have been in a cardboard box, if I remember right. And I really probably only watched it the one time. And then never watched it again until I watched it this week.
Yeah.
Which is kind of unfortunate because I thought that it was very good.
Yeah.
I don't know why I never have given it another thought. I think because, you know, it kind of gets lost amongst all the Batman movies, like from my childhood. that's what I really remember looking forward to when it came to superhero movies was Batman.
Yeah.
And I think for whatever reason as a kid, I just didn't appreciate The Rocketeer as much as it deserved, which is odd because I really, really loved the movie The Phantom with Billy Zane.
Okay.
And I would say that those two movies are comparable. If not, The Rocketeer is probably like a little bit better than The Phantom, in my opinion.
They could easily be in the same universe, that's for sure.
Yeah.
There were a lot of things about it that I think it kind of suffered from confusing marketing and things like that.
Yeah.
The original poster is very, it's a really cool poster. It's the one that's used on probably the video that you got. It's sort of an Art Deco kind of look, but it's a little, I think it maybe confused people. They hastily redid the poster to show the cast on there, and they often use that one sometimes on some of the other promo kind of stuff. But I think it was also, you know, sandwiched between like Robin Hood and Prince of Thieves and then Terminator 2 when it came out.
Yeah.
And I think it was like one of those films that, you know, had a comic book there, but it was a pretty obscure comic book that got passed around between so many different publishers. And so it is like a niche kind of like cultish following from the 80s, and then but it wasn't Batman, you know, it wasn't like Terminator or those kind of things like that. And so I think you're probably right, it often would get lost among other things. And Disney, they did the exact same thing with the cartoon. They had just no clue like how to like effectively market this. They didn't want to originally set it in the 30s. They wanted it to be like sort of a modern day thing. They didn't want to use the original helmet.
That's really weird to me, because I feel like the Rocketeer, I could easily see the Rocketeer being one of those characters that like an executive or somebody who doesn't know anything might like look at it and be like, oh, I don't know what to do with this. But I don't know, his look is really cool.
Mm-hmm. And functional.
Like, I think he looks awesome and functional.
Yeah.
And I think especially in the context of the 1930s, like, I don't know how they do it in the cartoon, make it in the modern day, but I feel like the Rocketeer could have easily been like a pulp like Netflix series. Like, it has
potential. Like,
yeah, it has a lot of potential to do a lot of things, right?
Yeah, so it was supposed to be three movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think scripts were ever really written for the other two, but based on the performance of this one, I mean, it didn't tank. It just, you know, I don't think it performed the way they were hoping it would exactly.
No, it profited, but only by like $7 million. So, you know.
Yeah. I had completely forgot that it was based on a graphic novel. I thought graphic novels that have come out since were based on the movies, but I saw recently that IDW, they made like two volumes with like, basically like they got like current comics writers and artists to go back and look at the old stories and then kind of like revamp them a little bit, and they put out some updated versions that I got on my library app, so I didn't have time to read them before we did this, but I'm definitely looking forward to reading them in the coming weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's quite a few comic kind of updates that they did to kind of continue things a little bit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The story in the comics are a little bit different. I don't know if you necessarily want to go into that.
Oh, well, let's jump into The Rocketeer. Sure. And whenever you find something that strays from the comic, you can let us know. It's directed by Joe Johnson, who is the director on Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, the original Jumanji, The Wolfman, Jurassic Park 3, and Captain America, The First Avengers, which I read, it was this movie that kind of made them realize, hey, he'd be perfect for Captain America. And we finally get to talk about someone involved in the MCU Captain America rather than the 1990 Captain America, which is always the one that ends up on this show. It's produced by Charles Gordon, who was a producer on Hitman, Girl Next Door, Waterworld, Field of Dreams, Die Hard 1 and 2, and is also produced by Lawrence Gordon, who was a producer on Predator 1 and 2, Die Hard 1 and 2, Lara Croft, Tomb Raider, Time Cop, Mystery Men, the old Hellboy, the new Hellboy, and the animated series, plus the Watchmen movie and series. So this guy's got some pretty good credits under his belt. One more producer, Lloyd Levin, who has many of the same credits I just mentioned with the two Gordon brothers. And it's written by Paul DeMeo, who has a lot of video game credits like Company of Heroes, Medal of Honor, and most of the 007 games. And he was also a writer on a 1984 Helen Hunt movie called Trancers, as well as the
good movie.
Have you actually seen that?
Yeah, so they did a lot of B movies. He and his writing partner Paul DeMeo and Danny Bilson, they've done a number of films, and I think they were actually thinking that was the original thought for the Rocketeer. They had a hard time finding like a taker for it, and they might do it kind of on an indie level with Dave Stevens, who's the one who did the comic. as the Rocketeer, who he drew himself essentially.
Yeah.
So he looks remarkably like Bill Campbell, who was the lead.
That's awesome.
But yeah, so Transfers, there's a whole series of Transfers movies.
Yeah, there's five sequels. Yeah, I've never even heard of the first one, and I couldn't believe that there's six of them. So. He also developed the original Flash series and the series Viper, which I remember was kind of a Knight Rider ripoff, except with a Dodge Viper. It's also written by Danny Bilson, who Josh just mentioned, who has an almost identical credit list, and also written by William Deere, the writer behind a bunch of movies I've never heard of, like Elephant Parts, Simon Says, Time Rider, The Adventures of Lyle Swan, and Dr. Duck's Super Secret All-Purpose Sauce. Literally, the only credits of his I recognize are this and Harry and the Hendersons. So, and finally, written by Dave Stevens, who I don't know if he was actually a writer on this, but he is the creator of the Rocketeer graphic novel. And so we open this movie on uplifting piano music, and we see an old school airplane, which is the BG, or no, GB. Which
GB.
Way does it? GB, yeah, okay.
Yeah. I only know that because I was watching this with the subtitles on, and I saw that it was GB, and I was like, I wonder if the BGs got their name from something to do with this airplane.
Well, I believe this is actually a style of airplane, is the GB.
Yeah.
Like, it's I at first I thought it was the name of the plane, but I guess all these racing planes are GB.
So it is a model type, and it is a style. But yeah, it's a specific model, kind of like, you know, like a P-51 or these other kinds of ones. And it was built, there's a couple of different versions. The version that Cliff is flying is, I believe, the GB-Z. And they were built for speed. So it was like an engine with wings, and it's a very short and stubby airplane with a really powerful engine. And every single one of them that has ever been created has crashed. It was sort of a death trap. And the one that they used for the film was a reproduction, although I think that one has since crashed. But I mean, they've made reproductions. When you see photographs of them, then they're flying in the air in color. Those are all reproductions because there's no surviving ones.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the other thing I read about this one that they had in the movie is that there was a limited amount of times that they were allowed to land this plane because of how hard it is on the landing gear. So it's like, if you don't get the shot after, you know, we landed X amount of times, too bad.
Yeah.
Well, I was actually wondering about that in the scene where the plane crashes after he goes to the field and everything, and it gets all shot up. Like, the way that the wheels or whatever, the wheel pegs, like, that are on the wings, they just kind of, like, tear away.
Yeah.
I seem to remember something that I think the guy's name who was flying, who was actually doing the flying, I think his name is Craig Hoskins, something like that. Essentially, you know, stuntman, doing a lot of air work, you know, and stuff like that in movies. And I think he said, you know, it was just always a white knuckle experience flying that GB, you know.
Yeah.
Even flying it after the movie was done, like trying to return it when possible to fly it from place to place, they would rather transport it, you know, by like
flatbed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I believe it came from some, I could be mistaking this, but it wasn't local to the area. So they had to get it there. And I think they had to fly it. So in the comic book, Cliff, he goes on this cross country kind of thing. He was actually flying the GB from, you know, California all the way, you know, to Europe. Well, he's flying to the East Coast. So just the idea of even doing that, I don't know. I mean, that must have been probably not realistic, but probably hell, you know.
Yeah, probably.
Tiny little airplane with no visibility.
Yeah.
So we're at Bigelow Airfield, and we meet our hero of the movie, Cliff Secord, who is played by Billy Campbell, who plays Dave Secord in the new Rocketeer cartoon. And he was in Cardinal, The Killing, recurring roles on The OC and The 4400. He was in Enough, Bram Stoker's Dracula, and a movie called Dickwad. And I did read, though, that Kevin Costner and Matthew Modine were considered, but unavailable. Emilio Estevez, Bill Paxton, Dennis Quaid all auditioned. Michael Keaton, Alec Baldwin, Mel Gibson, Harrison Ford, Ron Perlman, and Tom Hanks were all considered. Johnny Depp was Disney's favorite for the role. And Richard Marx, the singer, Richard Marx, turned down the role of Cliff Secord.
It's his loss.
Yeah.
Literally.
That's quite a, like, can you imagine a Ron Perlman Rocketeer? Hellboy as Rocketeer? Like,
I get picture Richard Marx in this film. Kind of, he kind of looks the part.
Maybe a little bit, yeah.
Interesting.
So Cliff is getting prepared to test fly a plane and is accompanied by the mechanic slash engineer Peavy, who is played by Alan Arkin, who was in Argo, Little Miss Sunshine, Glengarry, Glen Ross, Edward Scissorhands. And in 1968, he played Inspector Clouseau in a movie called Inspector Clouseau. I never realized anyone other than Peter Sellers, or I guess Steve Martin, had ever played the role of Inspector Clouseau, though. I've never heard of this movie.
I didn't know that either.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I read that Lloyd Bridges was a possibility for Peavy.
Yeah. I think the Peavy character, you know, was actually based on a mentor that Dave Stevens, you know, the original writer had when he was working in his sort of day job, essentially.
Yeah.
And it's who he based him off in the comic book. So the comic book version of Peavy looks quite a bit different.
Okay.
Okay. Is he older then? Is he more like Lloyd Bridges?
No. He's elderly. He's sort of like kind of lanky. He's got glasses. Okay. It's the same kind of personality though. You know, kind of crotchety.
Yeah. So we find out that Cliff's thing is to randomly stick chewing gum to things. In this case, the fin of his plane. Is this a thing? Like, is this actually a good luck thing that I don't know about? Like throwing salt over your shoulder or something like that?
I've never heard of that, although I think it, you know, comes back in the movie later, which I'm sure you'll talk about.
Yeah.
But I mean, the gum that he uses, so Beeman's gum, but that's sort of famous with aviators.
Yeah, and I know it's used in like other movies, the good luck Beeman's gum, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of like flight superstition in that opening scene, because doesn't he say something about like the plane being freshly painted is like a bad omen?
Something like that. I don't remember exactly, but
at least the backstory in the comic book was that Cliff was somebody that Peavy kind of took under his wing. Was kind of like a runaway, had been in a circus for a while, and it was kind of fell in love with the GB and thought about a way to make quick cash, you know, from it, because at the time racing planes and everything like that would turn in some bucks, I guess.
Yeah.
But it took him a long time to actually find one that actually would actually work. So by 1938, actually, I don't know how much of that racing was actually being done, because a lot of it was done actually in the early 30s. By the later part of it, I don't know how many people are actually using GBs anymore.
Yeah.
But apparently in the story, in the comic book, they found one, they had to fix it up because it all crashed. They had to fix it up. And so I think the movie is sort of saying like, okay, this is the first flight of this plane that they have just spent years like, you know, trying to build. So that's why he's saying like, don't mess it up, because we've just, you know, put all our life savings into getting this plane operational.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like these planes are, they're something. But when I see the guy starting the propeller out front, I ask myself, like, I wonder how many people have died starting the propeller of a plane. Like, you know, not a propeller already in motion, like in Indiana Jones, the Nazi that gets splattered against the plane. I'm talking about just starting it up because, like, you know, he has to heave on it a couple times and then jump back just in time.
Well, I think, you'd have to talk to a pilot or someone who knew that at the time. But one thing he says in the very beginning that he says, make her hot.
Yeah, it's like pulling the choke on your lawnmower.
Yeah, exactly. But before that, I think it, you know, it wouldn't do anything if you just like tried to spin the propeller or something. But I imagine it probably took some practice to be able to do that safely.
Yeah, I guess.
So we cut to an exciting car chase in 1930s vehicles with people getting shot at. And we find that the one car that's being chased has an authorized personnel only briefcase sitting in it. And the plane just happens by while this car chase is going on, and it gets shot up by some stray gunfire. Oh man, the oil in the face, that would suck.
Yeah.
Like I like how he just punches out the glass to be able to see, but wow, like
yeah.
They did not plan for oil being all over the windshield when you're in the air.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always wondered, like, you know, what would you do if your windshield of any of these planes got splattered with something? You know, how would you even clean, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if they had any, like, kind of windshield wipers.
And, I mean, if you can just punch the glass out that easily, like, birds must be a problem.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking, like, what kind of, I don't know how advanced airplanes were at this stage in the game, but how did these planes differ from, like, the planes that they would have been using in the war? Because I was just thinking, even when they put, like, that capsule on him, after he sits in and that's like the cockpit or whatever, but
there
was no eject or anything like that.
No ejection, no parachute. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in World War II, wouldn't the Air Force planes have been biplanes? Like, isn't that what you always see? The Red Baron shooting down.
Oh yeah. In World War One. Yeah. World War One. Yeah. you know, by, you know, going into like 1938, they would have been, you know, pretty advanced. I mean,
yeah, I think I can picture it. Yeah.
Yeah, so the plane that Cliff was supposed to be flying in a later scene, but the biplane that he saves Malcolm from. So that would have been something in World War One.
Yeah,
this would have been, you know, where it's the airplanes are held together, the cloth and wood, and this, you know, by World War Two, you know, or that time, the planes are made of metal.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
oh yeah, they were. Yeah,
there was, you know, probably a more advanced kind of cockpit and everything like that. You know, to keep people in. But as I mentioned, you know, the Jeep was something from sort of a previous era, almost. You know, there's sort of a early 30s. And so there's still some things about it that were a little bit, I guess, would be almost considered kind of primitive by the time that World War II came around, which is just sort of around the corner for at this time of this movie.
Yeah. So they end up getting to Bigelow Airfield and hiding in one of the hangars. And the one guy that was driving finds out that his buddy that was in the rumble seat is dead, but they can't get caught with the gizmo that they've got. That's one of the words they use, is gizmo. I like the 30s language. And so they replace whatever was in the briefcase with a Hoover vacuum. And I think that means it's time for Sponsorship Corner. So always on the lookout for product placements in movies. This week, The Rocketeer is brought to you by Hoover Vacuums, Sun-Made Raisins, Cracker Jacks, Coca-Cola, Ford, Harley-Davidson, Hughes Aircraft, the LA Times, the movie Jezebel starring Betty Davis, and Beeman's Pepsin Gum. Plus, a special shout-out to the fictional Bigelow Aeronautical Corporation, Lucky Lindy's Flight School, the South Seas Club, and the Bulldog Cafe. And this has been Sponsorship Corner.
So there's a audio recording that was meant for kids that came out at the same time that Disney put out. And they actually don't use the word gizmo when referring to the rocket pack. What they use is like an old definition of the word dingus.
Oh, okay. Right on.
The guy says, "I got the dingus stash real good." It's like, "Yeah, I bet you do."
That's something you could get arrested for otherwise.
But I guess that's, it means like a, you know, like essentially like a gizmo or a thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's funny. That's awesome. I mean, you know, all my old Ukrainian relatives, it was always thingamajigs and whatchamacallits, but yeah, dinguses are pretty good. So the plane ends up crashing. And everyone is pissed off because the FBI are the reason for the crash, and Cliff punches out the FBI guy. They ruined his plane.
I love that scene so much. I love the fact that they both just take straight punches to the jaw, and they're just standing and fine. Like, neither of them hits the ground. Like, that's a solid punch.
But, okay, do you think the FBI should have been responsible for the damages, though?
No, I actually, to go back to that whole scene, I feel like I don't understand what Cliff was doing. I mean, I guess he doesn't know that there's a shootout happening.
Yeah.
But, I don't know, why are you getting so close?
Yeah. I mean, and like, don't they have insurance?
And that.
Like,
well,
don't they have something that covers bullet holes? I don't know. Like, you'd think Bigelow would have insurance. He's quite a smarmy businessman.
I wonder if any of that would have existed at the time. I mean, but I imagine that Cliff, with, as he called himself, you know, an out-of-work pilot with holes in his pocket, I don't think he probably would have had anything like that. And, I can't imagine Bigelow. I don't know. He seemed like sort of like a shady type. I don't know if he would have. I don't know.
Well, in this scene, the FBI does find the gizmo, or the dingus, the supposed X-3, and it's been blown up, but it's actually the vacuum. And then we cut to Howard Hughes, who is played by Terry O'Quinn. Man, he's so young. Like, because I know him best from as Locke on Lost, and he's so much older now. But he's also from movies like Tombstone, Young Guns, The Stepfather in 1983, Hawaii 5-0. He had a recurring role on that. And he refuses to build another X-3. And boy, he's such a different Howard Hughes than Leonardo DiCaprio was in The Aviator. Or Mr. Burns was on The Simpsons. I mean, he, you know.
Yeah, I thought Howard Hughes was like a weird guy. Not,
yeah, a sheltered recluse.
Didn't he become kind of like a hermit almost, and like stop shaving and stop cutting his fingernails, and like no one saw him for
peeing in jars famously
10 years or something like that.
Yeah. So this must be before that started happening, I guess.
Yeah, I think the later years of his life, like, he had totally untreated OCD, and so, but he was rich enough that he could, you know, he could kind of have people accommodate his dietary requests or these other kinds of things, but he totally stopped taking care of himself. But I think at this particular point, he was more functional, and yeah, he was an aviator himself, but I think he ran into problems, I think, with something with movies, I think, but a lot, but some also with pain, you know, in his body from crashes.
Yeah. Well, I know that in this scene, there is one insult that gets said, and I don't think I've ever heard it anywhere else. You lousy nickel nurser. Like, that's got to be a 30s-ism that just doesn't exist anymore. But, like, what does it mean? Like, does it mean you're cheap?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
There's a lot of great 30s slang in here.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the G-men are like, your buddy's being fitted for, like, a pine overcoat.
Yeah.
Which the stuff like that. I mean, when I first saw the movie, I was seeing it, and there were no subtitles or anything like that. So sometimes you can always hear stuff and didn't understand what they were saying. So I always thought, your buddy's being fitted for a flying overcoat, which I didn't really understand. but I still hear, like, in my mind, I still hear, like, these little things that I heard as a kid because I've seen that movie so many times. But there's a lot of great slang in there.
Oh, yeah. And so we go back to Bigelow Airfield, and Cliff finds something under the seat of one of the planes in the hangar. I love on this biplane the Band-Aid decoration on it. I don't know what it is about it. It's so simple, but man, like, it's beautiful. I love it.
Yeah.
But he finds the gizmo, the dingus, the X-3, the rocket, and I love when he pushes the button and it just flies around the shop. Like, the green screen effects, I will say, like, right up front, some of them are really weak,
yeah,
but it's still
sure.
Cool, this whole scene of the thing just bouncing around the hangar.
Mm-hmm.
And then we cut to Neville Sinclair, who is played by Timothy Dalton, who was in Flash Gordon, Hot Fuzz, Beautician and the Beast, Doom Patrol, Penny Dreadful, the voice of Prickle Pants in Toy Story, but really, he's one of the James Bonds. I read that Charles Dance, I'm not sure who that is, and Jeremy Irons were both possibilities for Neville Sinclair.
Jeremy Irons would have been epic.
Yeah?
But yeah. Timothy Dalton is still awesome.
Yeah. But I can't tell. Is Timothy Dalton doing an American accent? Because he's not full British, but like...
He's doing a German being an American.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. It struck me as like he had Americanized a bit of it, but it kind of seemed like he kept certain parts around because it made him kind of feel like or look, you know, kind of suave. But then, interesting, later in the movie, he reverts to sort of like an English that has like German accents to it.
Yeah.
Which is kind of weird. I never really understood that part, but you know.
Yeah. I feel like his accent is just a little all over the place. Like, I don't think he knew what he was doing. Might be some places it's stronger than others. It's just, it threw me off. Cause if he's doing an accent, it's not very good.
Yeah.
Well, we find out that Neville also wants the famed X-3 rocket. So to make his dream a reality, he calls a thug named Lothar with another job for him. And he specifically says another. I wonder what kind of jobs Lothar has done in the past for him.
Mm.
Like, how deep is this guy?
I love that he calls this job a condolences job.
Yeah. But even though we don't see his face in the scene, I'll introduce Lothar. He's played by Tiny Ron Taylor, who was a basketball player. He's 7'1", played center. He played from 1969 to 1972. He was drafted by the Seattle Supersonics. He never actually played for them, though. He played for the Washington Caps, the New York Nets, Virginia Squires, and the Pittsburgh Condors. Caps, Squires, and Condors were all ABA teams. That's why you probably never heard of them. Like, you being a Pittsburgh boy, Josh, have you ever heard of the Condors?
I have not, no.
No? Okay. But as an actor, I never knew he also plays Al in The Naked Gun. You know, the super tall cop whose face you never see? You know, like, there's the one I remember vividly where it's like you've got a little something on your lip and he brushes it off and it's like half a banana. But And he's also in Ace Ventura, Colin. He's one of the two henchmen that abducts Dan Marino.
Oh, interesting.
That makes sense. I didn't put it together, but sure.
No, neither did I until I read that. I'm like, holy shit, really? So back with Cliff and Peavy, they have stolen a statue to experiment with for testing the rocket. And we get another 30s-ism here. We get Chowderhead. Oh, man, I love it.
Chowder.
Yeah, I love them stealing this statue to test the rocket out in the field. And that's great. Like, the whole bit where it's, like, flying around on its tether. And of course, this ends with the statue with the caved in head, where he says, "I think we're going to need a helmet." But is that a hollow statue? Or did they like crush a full solid bronze statue by crashing it? Because I don't think a helmet's going to help you, Cliff, if that's the case.
I have the impression that the statue is made of something else, like, you know, because they saw it off.
Yeah, I thought it was like wood or something like that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
See, I thought it was a metal statue. I thought they were just sawing it at the base, so I thought maybe that's where it's joined by wood or joined by pegs that you can saw through.
Maybe. It's supposed to be, I don't know if you saw the name of the school is Lucky Lindy's Flight School.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be a Charles Lindbergh statue.
Oh, okay. See, I mentioned Lucky Lindy in my sponsorship corner, but I did not think of the Lindbergh connection.
Yeah. Huh. Mm-hmm.
So Cliff goes to pick up his best gal, Jenny, at her college dormitory. Or is this actually college, or is it like a movie studio dormitory?
I thought it was like a boarding house, you know, he's renting a room there, you know.
Okay, so it's neither then.
That was my impression. So in the comic book, she wasn't an actress. So this is one thing that Disney changed, because when Dave Stevens did the comic book, he had made the character of Jenny, who we called, the original name was Betty. Mm-hmm. And if you look back at the pictures, you'll see she looks remarkably like pinup girl Betty Page.
Okay, yeah.
You didn't actually know she was alive, apparently. She was still alive at the time.
Okay.
You were doing this in the 80s. She just was leading a more sheltered life at that time. And so he used her likeness. When Disney, they were like, this is going to be a family film. That's a little bit not where the direction we want to go. And so they changed her from, instead of being a, kind of like an actress who dabbles in, erotica or whatever, to just an actress starting out. And they changed her name to Jenny.
Okay.
Hmm.
So he gets there to pick up Jenny. And I mean, Cliff just sticks his fucking gum anywhere. Like, if on the fin it was for luck, or and later on the rocket, if it's for luck, why did he stick it to the door of the dormitory? What luck did he need?
Maybe he's going to hope to get lucky tonight. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, there we go. Oh, my God. Like, it was right there. The word was even right there.
Okay.
So they go to the movies to see a Neville Sinclair movie. Man, courting in the 30s is just so special, yet crazy. It's just so fun to watch. If this is just a boarding house, you know, the fact that it's like, you know, the woman comes, the matron of the building comes to the door to let him in. That's why I thought maybe it was a school dormitory, but I didn't even think about, yeah, I guess in the 30s there probably were women's dormitories.
Yeah, it's just, it's
the idea of courting in the 30s is so crazy to me. I don't know.
Yeah.
But Jenny is played by a very young, very beautiful Jennifer Connelly.
The most beautiful woman in the history of the world, I think.
Yeah, she is gorgeous in this movie. She was also in The Hulk, the Ang Lee one, not the MCU one, Inkheart, The Day the Earth Stood Still, A Beautiful Mind, Labyrinth, and here's a credit I had no idea. She is Suit Lady, a.k.a. Karen, in Spider-Man Homecoming.
Oh, wow.
Like, it's interesting that both her and her husband voiced artificial intelligence in the MCU. Because, I mean, obviously, famously, she's Paul Bettany's wife as well. But, yeah, I did not know she was the Suit Lady. That I thought that was great. I also read Jenny could have also been played by Sherilyn Fenn. I don't know who that is. Kelly Preston, Diane Lane, Elizabeth McGovern, or Kindergarten Cop's Penelope Ann Miller.
Hmm.
But I'd rather look at a young Jennifer Connelly all day, every day, man. It's okay. I'm glad she's the one that got this part. Jenny and Cliff are now at the Bulldog Diner after their movie, and Jenny finds out that Cliff actually crashed and he didn't tell her. So is this a 30s thing, not opening up to the person you're courting?
That's a man thing.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a timeless man thing? Okay.
It knows no decade.
Well, she gets upset at him and storms out. I love the little diner family here, though, like including the guy who plays Jonathan Kent and Lois and Clark and Larry, or is it one of the Daryl brothers from Newhart? It's Larry and this is my brother Daryl and my other brother Daryl. He's one of the guys, but I think he's Larry. But I just love this little family where they're like, oh, go after her. And
yeah, you know, in talking to some of the folks who made the Rocketeer cartoon, I've since learned that there actually is still a bulldog cafe that you can actually visit in Los Angeles.
Oh,
So there was like there was a, you know, there actually was a Bulldog Cafe as part of many of the things that were like this in that time period, shaped like different things.
Yeah, like the Brown Derby. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, Dave Stevens being a fan of all these things in that time period, you know, based his version of the Bulldog Cafe for the Rocketeer on the actual building. Mm-hmm. But there is a one you can go to that it's like a miniaturized one, I guess, in a bar called Idle Hour, actually, which I since learned from talking to the people who helped make the cartoon. And Esther, one of the guests who came on my show, she was telling me that they actually went there as kind of like a crew bonding.
Okay, yeah.
Just to we'll take some pictures in the Bulldog Cafe.
Yeah. Well, see, I mean, in Sponsorship Corner, I said that, you know, I listed that under the fictional, so I guess I have to bump that up in my Sponsorship Corner, knowing that it was actually a real place in the 30s. So while Cliff has been wooing and unwooing Jenny, Peavy has been trying to figure out the X3 and building a helmet. So Cliff wakes up in the morning, sees the helmet, and says, "He's gotta be kidding. It's like a hood ornament." That's something cars are missing these days, these big artistic hood ornaments. That's why that line can only work in the 30s, is because that's the era of cars that has these big, bulky hood ornaments on them.
And I believe, I forget the model of the car, but I did it in one of my previous episodes. I think it's a Packard or something like that. But if you look at, if you just Google like 30s hood ornaments or something like that, you'll see a bunch of like sort of Art Deco kind of flying mm-hmm. men that kind of look exactly like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we head back to Neville Sinclair's world where he is filming. So knocking a flower off people's chest with his sword is just kind of his thing, huh?
Yeah, I guess. he
did it to the mobsters earlier, and now it's actually something that he does in the movie. But Cliff shows up on the set looking for Jenny, who is a background actress in the scene. And it's weird to think of a time when there'd be zero security at a Hollywood studio. He just walks in. Yeah. And he's watching from behind the scenes. He knocks over the wall. So now the scene has to be reset because the wall got knocked over. And, oh, because one of Neville's co-stars has accidentally been stabbed by Neville. Why wasn't there a bigger deal being made about this?
This is one of those parts I never really understood. And I always wondered if like they filmed an extra scene or something like that, but we never got any deleted scenes or anything like that.
Yeah.
I kind of took it to mean like, well, you know, Neville's kind of this narcissistic guy who's just going to, you know, he doesn't really care that much about people. It's like, whatever. He's just going to. But I often wondered, is there a scene or a sort of a subplot that was deleted for why he wanted to either stop production on the movie or take this particular co-star out of action or something like that?
I thought that there was going to be something about him, because I kind of missed this part the first time I watched it.
Yeah.
And then when I was watching, I just saw like, oh, this guy got stabbed. Then when I was watching it the second go around, I was like, it seems, even the way that they're interacting, like this guy, maybe he knew that Neville was a spy.
Right.
And Neville was trying to take him out.
Yeah. When I saw it the very first time when I was a kid, that's what I actually thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when I watched it every other time, I was like, well, did they add a scene that I, you know, like sometimes like they'll add scenes when they have to cut stuff out or whatever otherwise, you know, don't have in the formal release. But no, I don't know. I just must have imagined that. But that's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah. Because it's also weird to think if Cliff hadn't knocked over the wall, things would have just kept going and that guy had already been stabbed like minutes ago.
Yeah.
And no one was like, no one had stopped production for
He's
that.
Like,
they stopped
yeah.
because the wall falls down.
Yeah.
So while this filming is on its break, Cliff pulls Jenny aside to tell her about the engine that you strap on your back, which Neville happens to overhear. Yahtzee! But because it's supposed to be a closed set, and again, this seems like a security issue, Jenny gets fired, and Neville Sinclair chases after Cliff, just shoving people out of the way. Like, just all willy-nilly. Yeah. And of course, everyone is, like, getting in his way. Like, they don't see him push the first guy and be like, oh, you know what? Maybe he's in a hurry. But he ends up losing Cliff. So the backup plan, Neville decides he's going to use Jenny by getting her unfired. And so I haven't really talked about the other couple storylines intertwining with everything else. We've got Bigelow and Valentine. Bigelow played by John Polito, who has 221 credits. He's the money man behind these guys competing in the races and is threatening to take away everything because of the wrecked plane. And then there's the mobsters headed by Eddie Valentine, played by Paul Sorvino. But I read that Joe Pesci was a possibility for Eddie Valentine.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He turned it down. Neville is using him to get the X3. and who in return, these mobsters are losing patience with Neville. And so now we go to the plane race where Cliff is supposed to be performing as a clown for Bigelow to try to make up some of the bad blood there. I don't even know how this begins to start paying him back, yeah. But not a regular clown. An airplane flying clown? What's the point of a clown flying a plane? I mean, I doubt you'd see who is flying the plane from the ground, even with an open cockpit.
Yeah, so there's the name of his plane is called the Fearless Freep, which you have to like kind of watch it with the subtitles on to catch a lot of the stuff.
Okay.
So I haven't seen this cartoon in a long time, but it is a it's from a Bugs Bunny. High Diving Hare is the cartoon. And one of the main attractions is Fearless Freep in it. And so you can watch that on YouTube, High Diving Hare with Bugs Bunny. I don't know if that's a reference to it. But it's like one of those things. And I don't know if that has any clowns in it. It's like one of those little details that they threw in there that may or may not relate to anything. But it's kind of an interesting thing in itself.
Nice.
Meanwhile, the gangsters are also at the plane race searching for the X-Tree. They don't find it, but they do find a picture of Jenny. And this is going to come in useful for them.
Yeah.
Well, because Cliff is running late, his diner pal Malcolm decides to dress like a clown to cover for him. But he hasn't flown in like 25 years. But that's when Cliff shows up and seeing that things are going badly up there because he's getting in the way of race planes. Cliff puts on the rocket suit to save Malcolm. I'm assuming the race is still happening and that's why those other GBs are still out there, right? Like, why would you send a clown up in his plane during the race? Like, wouldn't this be like, we're 250 laps into the Indy 500, let's send clown cars out onto the track. Like, that's yeah. kind of what this strikes me as, is the race wasn't exciting enough for you?
Yeah, I think I wonder if it was meant as sort of like comic relief almost, kind of like a circus where the clowns are kind of messing around, but they're actually doing like fairly difficult acrobatics, but they're also like, they're just kind of like there as comic relief. I was wondering if that's part of like what they were sort of doing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just odd to me. So on the ground, Bigelow has taken over as announcer with these new developments up in the sky. It's interesting to think of a time when someone has to be on a microphone assuring the crowd that it's all part of the show. It's all part of the show.
Right till the very end, right till the explosion hits the ground.
Yeah. And I love the moment of like, once this all happens, all the press people running to the phone booths and all trying to cram into the phone booths at the same time.
Yeah.
But Cliff, who ends up saving Malcolm, now ends up going for a little fly. And then he ends up accidentally pushing one of his buttons the wrong way and starts crash landing. He ends up flying through a clothesline and he has a sheet stuck over his head. How does this not catch on fire?
Yeah, how do his legs not catch on fire is the biggest question. You know?
Okay.
there's that.
The boots.
Yeah. The riding pants, basically, yeah.
Yeah.
Fire retardant pants.
Yeah. But he ends up crash landing in a pond, and his first comment is, I like it. So this is when Peavy shows up to get him out of there so that no one finds him, and the truck just isn't moving fast enough. So I love the moment where it's just put it in neutral, you steer, I'll push.
Yeah.
That was a great moment.
A good one. And the part where he's flying through the cornfield and you can see like the two farmers are standing there. It's like a really short scene and they're like a big gopher. So the farmer to the right is Tiny Ron.
Okay.
Not in makeup. Yeah, you can see how tall he is.
Weird.
Yeah, little tiny roll.
Oh, that's cool.
Well, this new Rocket Man is big front page news. Bigelow pretends that he owns the idea, of course, and he gets named the Rocketeer. I find it interesting, though, that there's girls looking at it that, oh, they think he's so handsome. Like, with the mask on? Like, they do the same thing in Spider-Man. It's like, oh, he's so dreamy. It's like, you don't know what he looks like. He could look like Lothar under there. You know? So Lothar, meanwhile, is on the hunt for the rocket. FBI finds Bigelow folded in half. Was this cut out of that Disney Channel version that you had of this movie?
No, it was not.
Folded in half was in there? Okay.
It was in there, yeah. So the Lothar character is based on an actual actual, it's from the comic book, but Dave Stevens also based it on an actual actor, Rondo Hatton, I think.
Okay.
Who because of his appearance, he had acromegaly, and so overgrowth of certain areas, and he was used as a bad guy in a lot of period films, you know.
Yeah.
And so he based his appearance on that particular actor.
Nice.
And that's where Lothar comes from.
Well, now I feel a little bit bad about my, it could be Lothar under their comment.
Well, Lothar is not exactly the nicest person in this movie.
So then Lothar ends up tracking down Peavy and starts looking for the rocket at his house. And I like the fact that they disguise the rocket as a lamp. That was some quick thinking. Good job, Peavy.
Yeah.
But the FBI shows up because they've also followed the trail of Peavy, and they just open up fire on this house. How does no one get hit by a bullet?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they pumped in. It's like that scene in Predator where they just like, for like whatever, 20, 30 seconds, they just like, you know,
unleash into the forest. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. They hit nothing, right?
You know, yeah.
So Neville, meanwhile, is using Jenny for information and lust, I guess. I'm sure there are ulterior motives, and tries to woo her at the South Seas Club. I just got to say, man, I want a stage with a giant clam that opens up. I mean, this Big Band era is amazing. And then I'm watching it, and I went, oh my God, is that Jan from The Office?
Yeah!
Yes, Melora Hardin as the lounge singer here. Oh, but
Jan Levinson Gould, I presume.
Oh man, I couldn't believe it. I'm like, wow, she does other things.
What's crazy is she looks almost exactly the same as she does in the first season of The Office.
Yeah.
And it's like 15 years, probably.
Yeah. No. Well, yeah.
Office is 2004, 13 years.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I just, I looked at it, and maybe it was the idea of seeing her out of context that I couldn't believe it at first. Because you're right, it was definitely her, but it was one of the, it was a triple take for me. It wasn't even a double take, it was a triple take. And so we also get to meet W.C. Fields in this scene, who is such a pervert looking down Jenny's shirt while she's on her date with Neville.
Oh my gosh, that shot. Like, it's one thing to see the guy do it, but like the fact that they have to go into his eyes and be like, do that camera tilt, I was like, holy.
So also when not edited out of the Disney Channel.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's funny that they have Disney had an issue with her being based on Betty Page, but they didn't have a problem like having a like just a specific shot of her breasts.
Well, and because Disney Plus famously edits things, like I'm surprised that it was left in on the Disney Plus version that I watched, because like Splash is an example. There in Splash, there's a quick shot of Daryl Hannah's ass, and they actually digitally added hair to cover up her ass.
Oh, wow.
And so I'm surprised that they didn't go, let's lose this scene, because Disney Plus has really been editing things.
Interesting. I did not know they added. I saw my son was watching Aladdin recently, and I've seen for some of the cartoons, they have a little disclaimer in the beginning. It says like, this film contains depictions of people that are like sort of like offensive or whatever. They were wrong at the time and they're wrong now, but we're leaving them in because we hope they'll spark like discussion or something like that.
Oh,
like,
okay.
Interesting. Yeah.
So we cut back to Cliff and Peavy, who are now hiding out in the Bulldog Cafe. And I love the line, "We don't got a house, we got a gazebo." That's that was a great line after how much they just opened up on that house. But the mobsters come to the diner looking for Secord, and everyone is covering for him. But there was something about one of the guys in the back that I'm like, oh, he's going to turn snitch, isn't he? But he didn't, thankfully. I'm glad, because I like this family. I like this diner family.
Yeah.
But the thug sees Jenny's number written on the wall and calls it, pretends he's a florist with flowers for Jenny. Why is Jenny's number on the wall? Like, that's usually a graffiti trolling type thing, you know, like for a good time call.
Yeah.
You know? And I must say, I'm also disappointed that Jenny's number wasn't 8675309. But you know, like, even to make the connection of Jenny written on the wall and this picture, like, it's like, that's some loose threads that you're tying together there. Like, it's that's some very convenient storytelling in this case.
Yeah, well, it says, I think it says, like, love or Lady Luck or something like that, and it is very loose, you know.
Yeah.
But the so the character who does the calling is like, I got some flowers for Jenny. That guy, his name in the credits is Spanish Johnny.
Okay.
But that character actually comes back. So the two writers, Bilson and DeMeo, they did a comic book like some years later. And I think it's called Red Menace. And it's not a sequel to The Rocketeer, but it's almost like a spiritual sequel, I guess, in some ways, because there is a flying superhero who has a rocket pack, and there's a young guy who wants to kind of be like him. And so, but Spanish Johnny comes back.
Nice.
Oh, okay.
And so it's like same world, and Spanish Johnny, I think, meets his demise in that particular comic book. So.
Oh, see, that's too bad, because we need to figure out a way to get Spanish Johnny into the Phantom so that we can link that universe for Colin.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
I want a Phantom cartoon now. They can make a cartoon out of the Rocketeer. They can make it. Well, they did make one back in like early 2000s, but they should make a new one for kids.
Yeah. Well, the thug discovers that Jenny went to the South Seas Club with Neville, and they leave a couple gunmen behind to guard everybody. But the cafe all rises up and bands together and takes out the gunmen, and Cliff goes after Jenny with the rocket, but it's got a hole in it from the shootout, so something got hit at least. And so they fix it with gum, because there's the piece of gum on that he stuck to his rocket earlier for luck, and so now they fill the hole with it. So we go back to the South Seas Club. Neville Sinclair is pretty smooth hitting on Jenny. Like, he's putting in his work.
Yeah.
You got to give him credit at least there. Because I know that he's got this motive of finding out where the rocket is or finding out where Cliff is. I never thought Timothy Dalton was the smoothest Bond, but, you know, he's got it here.
He makes a good villain. I think he did a nice job as a villain.
Yeah. So Cliff gets to the South Seas Club and decides to disguise himself as a waiter. I love how his leather jacket is sticking out from underneath the waiter jacket. Yeah. But I have to say, it's interesting how heavy he made the rocket look the first time he found it. Like, when he pulls it out of the biplane, he's like struggling with it, and oh my god, it's heavy. And then now that he's at the South Seas Club, he just tucks it under his arm and walks down the hall. Like, it's just continuity, Billy.
Adrenaline.
Okay. There we go. Mm-hmm. So disguised as a waiter, he goes up to the table where Jenny and Neville are pretending to be a waiter. And he's just such a creepy waiter. Like, no wonder Neville is like, do you have a problem? But I love his cover story of when he asks, are you new? No, I served you last time you were here, Mr. Sinclair.
Yeah.
So
someone had it in for tomato soup in this movie, because like in the Bulldog Cafe initial scene, like when they're after that, watch that movie after the date, Jenny gets splashed with her like tomato soup on her dress.
Okay.
And this time, you know, the soup, Cliff spills soup all over the tablecloth with almost kind of doing the same thing.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on there. But.
Maybe tomato soup was like the hot thing in 1930s. It was cheap. It was easy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Yeah. End of depression.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think of tomato soup, or I think of that scene every time I see tomato soup.
But you've probably never found a note at the bottom of your tomato soup.
Yeah.
Everybody would want one too. If it.
that's also a really great idea. I love that. The putting the note down and then covering it up with tomato soup. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Good job, Cliff. So he confesses to Jenny about being the Rocketeer, and she's like, who? That was a great moment. But he tells her to get to safety because Neville is a problem, and that's when the note floats up in her soup, and Neville sees the note. And Lothar also shows up at the club, too. And so we've now got like this daring escape of the Rocketeer is flying around the club. You know, now things are lighting on fire. All the tapestries and everything hanging.
Yeah.
Those are lighting on fire, but nothing was before. But what a daring escape up the laundry chute. That was a great moment.
Yeah.
I love that scene where he goes up the laundry chute and then he's like flying around the dining room on that table. Part of the charm of the Rocketeer, I think, is the fact that he never actually gets really good with the jetpack.
Yeah.
Like, he kind of figures things out a little bit, but he's never actually really adept at using it.
He never becomes Iron Man.
Yeah,
is what it exactly. Is. Yeah, it's like the whole movie is like that first scene in the first Iron Man where he's trying to figure it out in his garage.
Yeah,
that's what this whole movie is him trying to figure out how this works. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a scene where Jenny kind of looks back on, you're maybe probably going to get to this, but Jenny looks back on the action that's happening and sees all the chaos that's ensuing. Like, I almost thought that there was a line, but that there isn't, of her like either thinking to herself, it's like, oh, well, that must be Cliff, because like, look at all the trouble this he's causing. Look at what a mess he's making.
Well, he literally just said the word rocketeer to her. Like, yeah. She should be able to put the pieces together. Come on, Jenny. But yeah, Jenny ends up like leaving the club and then decides not to get in the cab, and she goes back into the club and ends up saving him because he's been covered in a net. But she ends up getting caught by Neville by means of chloroform on the face. And then Jenny wakes up in Sinclair's home. He's all ready to tell her the story of, they're blackmailing me. These are ruthless men. And then he's trying to seduce her, only all his lines are from his movies.
Yeah.
And she's listing them off. Hey, that was from this movie. I love it. Love it.
You get and to then... see Neville Sinclair, the sexual predator, which
yeah,
right, has new meaning in 2020 or 21, whatever.
Yeah.
It was before the Me Too movement.
Yeah. And I do also like the line at the end of it all where it's like, I finally played a scene with Neville Sinclair.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and she knocks him out and she goes into the library. And when she's in her library, her first thought is, well, shit, there must be a book here on this bookcase somewhere that is actually a secret switch to a secret passage. I know that's my first thought anytime I see a bookshelf. Or were secret passages just common in the 30s?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's kind of like, I think she saw him, like, the part where she wakes up and she kind of, like, peeks around. Yeah. She sees him, yeah, like, pull a book and then...
But
she doesn't actually know what it is.
Yeah, okay. I didn't
and then
make
finally
that
she's like pulling all the books, and then I think it's like the Conquest of Casanova, yeah, or something like that.
Yeah.
He puts two and two, yeah, together, and then she gets that one, and then...
Okay, yeah, no, I did not piece that together. But she finds his secret room, and we find out that Neville Sinclair is a spy, a saboteur, a fascist, or like I like to think he's a Nazi. Like, but he's not a good guy. And then Cliff, meanwhile, gets back to the diner, no one is there, and the phone rings. And we find out that they have Jenny. They're putting in kind of the demands of bringing the dingus to them. And I'm using that from now on. And they want him to meet them at the Griffin Observatory at 4 a.m. But we find out that Peavy is with Howard Hughes, and the FBI arrests Cliffs and brings him to Howard Hughes's place. I don't understand, like, did Howard Hughes just have that much power that they're going to run everything by? Or was it because he was the designer of the X3 that they decided that, okay, we're going to arrest someone, but bring him to your place?
Yeah. I don't know why they just take him to the station, but, you know, or whatever they normally would take them.
Yeah. So the Nazis, meanwhile, we find out, have been trying to make their own Rocket Man. And the FBI shows everybody a propaganda video, or was it Howard Hughes has the propaganda video?
Yeah, Howard Hughes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he has the propaganda video.
But it's all about how America is burning. And so Cliff insists, you've got to let me use it one more time, you know, because Cliff has put the pieces together that Neville Sinclair is a Nazi spy and that the Valentine gang is not important at all. And too bad, it doesn't matter what you guys think, I'm just going to take it anyway. And he flies out of there on the Spruce Goose. He takes the dingus to the Griffith Observatory. Neville, certainly, I must say, is good at reverse psychology in this scene. Because he takes off his coat and he goes, here, put this on because Jenny's cold. She says, I'd rather freeze. He says, you're right. I like you better looking like that. And then she takes the jacket. So a little bit more of that. Let's see how much of a sleazeball he is. But like masterful reverse psychology in that moment.
Yeah.
Cliff uses his knowledge about Sinclair being a Nazi spy, which gets the mobster Eddie angry. Because the mob apparently doesn't like Nazis. Understandable. I can't say I'm a fan either. But this is when Sinclair yells in German and there's like 150 Nazi soldiers just hanging around. How did you not see these people hiding in the bushes from the sky, Cliff? Like, yeah. Is it because it's 4 a.m. and it's dark? Because the Griffith Observatory is a fairly well-lit location.
Yeah. I don't know if it was like they were supposed to be hiding in like the underbrush around there or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. You have to kind of suspend belief with some of this, a lot of this, yeah, you know. How did they all fit in? Presumably they came over in that Zeppelin, right?
Mm-hmm.
How'd they fit all those people in the Zeppelin? Right?
I feel like they would all be so tired as well. I was at the Griffith Observatory not that long ago, and it's like in the, like, it's, I can't remember what that valley is called, but like, it's basically just surrounded by valley and hills and stuff. Like, that's a lot to, that they would have to walk up to get up there. I'd be absolutely bagged by the time we got there. Yeah.
This whole scene just escalates super fast, because that's when the Zeppelin shows up and the mobsters start taking out the lousy krauts, and the FBI shows up, and we've got this whole like shootout happening. But like, World War II, you should have just sent the mob over there, because like, these guys are just mowing down Nazis left and right. Yeah. I do love the line though, "Happy Valentine's Day" for Eddie Valentine there. So
yeah.
See, you mentioned the one poster earlier. I always thought this was the poster, the hero shot of the Rocketeer by the American flag. I thought just before he goes after the Nazi blimp, I always thought that that was the poster. But maybe I'm mistaking it for like the cover of Bob Roberts, where he's like standing there wrapped in an American flag. But I don't know. I just,
yeah. So there is a bunch of them for the, you know how they used to, I don't know if they still do this, but like for movies, they would put out a little comic book, like movie adaptation of it that you could buy.
Yeah.
And so for that, the cover of that comic, so Dave Stevens didn't actually draw that particular comic, but he drew the cover, and it's a shot of like the Rocketeer, kind of like that, you know, with an American flag, like holding a gun. And there's another one. There's actually a video game, which is really weird, of the Rocketeer for the computer. Hmm. And they show that scene of the Rocketeer, like holding a gun, you know, the flag, but they show him holding like a super soaker, you know, one of those water.
Yeah.
Because for some reason they replaced the guns in there with, they call them like ray guns or whatever, but they look just like water guns.
Yeah.
Really weird.
Hmm.
Yeah, I feel like I remember that computer game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now that you mentioned it, I haven't thought of it in years, but I'm sure I've played that game. Huh. So he goes after them. Now, was this a glitch of me streaming it, or are the Germans just not subtitled on the blimp?
I don't think they were. You know, I don't think any, at least the version I watched, like the DVD version that I had, none of the German dialogue is subtitled.
Okay, because I've noticed that with Netflix sometimes, it glitches and you don't get the subtitles of the foreign-speaking people. Colin had that with Rush Hour, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When they spoke Chinese, it didn't show you what they were saying in English like it normally would on the DVD.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I was wondering whether maybe it was a glitch or whether they're legitimately not subtitled. Interesting choice if they're not subtitled. Okay, so on the blimp, what is Lothar's deal? Like, why is this guy... He can be kicked in the nuts and not hurt? Sort from the source, from the comic, like, does he have some sort of, like, he has no pain? Or, like, there's a character in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo that has no pain receptors. You know, so is that what his deal is? Or is it his, you know, the disease you were talking about?
No, none of that. I don't think. Okay. I think they just made it so that he was, you know, I guess super tough.
Okay.
Well, in fact, I think Cliff is the one who hurts his foot kicking him.
Yeah.
Kicking him in the junk.
I think
so,
yeah.
And the dingus, actually, you know, to be scientific, I guess.
So people are just dying all over the place here. I'm actually kind of surprised by the body count in this movie.
Yeah.
But so Cliff gets to the point where he has no choice but to hand over the rocket to Sinclair. But before he does, he slides that lucky gum off the hole. So the luck has finally really paid off. And I like the line of, "Where's your stuntman now, Sinclair?" He says, "I do my own stunts," which is actually a bit of a wink and a thumbs up to the camera here for Timothy Dalton, who famously did nearly all of his own stunts in his James Bond films.
Oh, wow.
Like, he definitely did more than any of the other Bonds. And so this is one of those, yeah, he actually does. Go Timothy Dalton.
Yeah.
With the little bit of research that I've done on this movie, like, I have so much more respect for Timothy Dalton, because he was always kind of the joke James Bond to me, but it's like, okay, no, he's actually got some, I don't like his, whatever his accent is, but he's got some great stuff going on, and I think I like Timothy Dalton more after watching this movie.
Yeah, I thought he was amazing in this movie. I felt like he stole the show a little bit as the villain.
Yeah.
And he looked like he was having a good time, you know? Like, really, like, enjoying
Well, because, yeah, he gets to be pompous, and then he gets to do that overacting when he's on the movie set. Like, he gets to do a lot of different things in this movie. Like, it's not just a black and white villain. It's, you know, there's all this, like, smarminess to him, you know?
He reminded me a lot of Prince Humperdinck in The Princess Bride.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So he was supposed to be, so in the comic book, there was no Neville Sinclair, exactly. There was a photographer who was, like, this sort of lecherous character. Who kind of is the same, similar, preying on young women, et cetera.
Yeah.
But the writers, when they made the movie, they were kind of basing like the urban legend of Errol Flynn being like a Nazi, you know, sympathizer or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And so that sort of laughing bandit, you know, Robin Hood style character that he's playing is, I think, was supposed to be like an ode to that. And like, you could probably have a lot of fun with like a character like that.
Yeah.
Character slash myth, slash, you know, what's real, what's not, who knows. I mean, but I imagine you guys know more about acting than me, but I mean, I imagine it would be great fun to do that.
No, yeah. For sure.
Yeah. So now Jenny ends up pulling out a flare gun. This doesn't seem safe in a blimp. Aren't they filled with highly flammable gas? Isn't there famously a blimp that crashed many years ago?
Yeah. There's an ode to that in the movie theater. They talk about being filled with hydrogen, and Cliff says, yeah, well, the last Goodwill tour buried half of Europe, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he's not referring to World War One or whatever, but I always thought it was kind of referring also to like the Hindenburg and, you know, the explosive hydrogen that they mentioned in that little newsreel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, yeah, flare gun, you know, maybe not the greatest choice of things to use.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we end up catching Neville Sinclair on fire. With the fuel dripping on his pants, though, shouldn't those have been the first thing that caught fire?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like his jacket goes up first or whatever. Like, you'd think, like, all the drips are landing on his pants, and those aren't the first thing that light on fire?
I don't know. Gravity, man. I don't know.
Yeah. But he ends up falling on the Hollywood Land sign, and now it's just Hollywood. I feel like this thing has been done in other movies before, where I've seen other reasons why the land goes missing off of Hollywood Land. But I like this one.
Yeah.
But, oh no, Lothar is still alive, and we get the exciting scene on top of the blimp, but Lothar gets blown up because he's tethered, but Cliff and Jenny manage to jump just in time to land in Howard Hughes' helicopter, because he's arrived just in the nick of time to save them. And then we get our denouement of the movie. Howard Hughes shows up at the diner. He says to Cliff, "You look awful blue for someone who just saved the world." But he asks, "What did it feel like strapping that thing onto your back and flying like a bat out of hell?" He says, "It's the closest I'll ever get to heaven." And then he sees Jenny and says, "Maybe not." Oh, yeah. You got to tell her that kind of stuff to her face, though, Cliff. Like, Neville was working it. You got to open up, man. Come on, Cliff. Lock that down.
Yeah.
But Howard Hughes gifts them with a new GB. And then Cliff goes over to Jenny and says, "What was that line again? Drink from my lips. Don't mind if I do." Boom. The end. The Rocketeer.
There we go.
So, Colin, Josh, on IMDb, this movie has scored a 6.5 out of 10 and has a Metascore of 61. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 66% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 65%. But Colin, those are just numbers, like Lothar getting kicked in the nuts. Hit us with some reviews.
All right. It's been a long time since I did some critic reviews, but I saw two that I liked, so. The first one is Dwayne Burge with The Hollywood Reporter. He says, "Undeniably, Rocketeer's overall trajectory is pleasing and winning, but it lacks the quirky charms and personal idiosyncrasies that endeared other big effects films to taut and sophisticated alike."
Okay.
Jason Bailey with Flavor Wire says, "In the quarter century since it's released, as the superhero blockbuster has become a cornerstone of mainstream movie making, it's become clear that The Rocketeer is a model of the form, breathless, energetic, and endlessly endearing."
Okay.
Now we have the Rotten Tomatoes super reviewers. So Connor R. says, "I can't help but love this movie. It's pure fun and a classic action-adventure movie. Anyone who enjoys Indiana Jones will also undoubtedly enjoy this as well. Also, this is basically the framework that Joe Johnson used for Captain America. It's just a really creative way to go about making a superhero pulp movie. The characterization is great. Billy Campbell does a good job, and you really care for him and his character. Timothy Dalton does his best evil Errol Flynn here, and it's one of the best performances, in my opinion. The visuals, pacing, story, and directing are all appropriately stylized to the 30s atmosphere they were going for. It's endlessly rewatchable and one of my favorite live-action Disney movies.
Yeah, I mean, we've done a lot of praising of Timothy Dalton and Jennifer Connelly in this movie, but Billy Campbell, I got to give a shout out to him because he's one of these guys that it's like, he's a handsome man. And I don't understand why he wasn't in more of these movies in the 90s. Like, he was a good leading man. And I don't, I'm surprised that, was it because this movie didn't perform as well as they wanted to, that he didn't become a bankable star? But I want to see more heroic Billy Campbell, you know?
Yeah. Last one from Tim W. He says, 3 out of 5 stars. It was cute, though dumb and simple. The characters were also simple and dumb. All felt a bit cliched, though perhaps that's a side effect of the whole purpose of the film. I laughed a few times, though I suspect mostly from unintentional means. Very low budget. Timothy Dalton always makes a wonderful villain.
Always. How many other villains has he played? I'm trying to...
I don't know.
Yeah. Always. Every time he's played a villain in this one movie, he... Yeah, I don't know how many villains he's played. There's bound to have been a few. Right on. So yeah, everything is just kind of floating around mid-60s for ratings in this movie. I mean, I don't think I have to ask, Josh. I mean, you have definitely exceeded my expectations with Rocketeer knowledge and knowing how much time you have given to this character in your podcast. Where does it fall for you?
I'm a little biased, to be fair.
Yeah, okay. So it you're a 10 favorite. Out of 10?
It is my favorite movie, so yeah. I mean, yeah. But...
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, I didn't say this up at the top, but the way that Colin described it when he was talking about his experience with it, that was almost exactly my experience as well, is I remember I saw this once, maybe twice when I was younger, when it first came out, and I don't think I've seen it since. I don't think I've seen this movie in 30 years, and just like what Colin said, I wonder why. Like, I should have revisited this movie. Maybe I have more appreciation for it now because, like, I love watching the era. I love the historical aspect of it. That whole, like you've said, that whole Art Deco style of everything that's happening here. Like, maybe I have more of an appreciation for it now. But, like, it was a fun movie. And right. Yeah. Why did it take me so long to get back to it? You know, it's...
I don't know. I think for all the reasons that you guys mentioned, you know, I think a lot of people probably felt that way.
I mean, now I heard you mention in your podcast at one point that it was a movie that you hadn't seen for a while before you refound this love for it because you were afraid of it possibly not holding up, but it exceeded your expectations at that point, eh?
That's true. Yeah, I mean, I watched it a lot as a kid and then I avoided it for a long time because I was like, well, you know, what happens if it's not that way? And then, and then I, you know, rewatched it, just sort of, I was like, well, I guess give it another try. And it wasn't that way at all. It was, I actually liked it more. In fact, so many things as a kid, I think I had kind of glossed over or missed.
Yeah.
And I hadn't also realized too, like how much of the film and the just the property in general had influenced kind of what I had, you know, written. I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Realize that that had all been kind of just going on under the behind the scenes,
yeah,
not even necessarily realizing it.
So Colin, I mean, at the top you kind of gave a strong opinion right out of the gate, so where does this fall for you then?
Yes, I mean, as a comic book fan and just a fan of all things like superheroes and superhero movies,
yeah,
I find, like, as much as I love, obviously, I love the MCU and all that stuff, I do have a real fondness for these older, like, superhero movies, for whatever reason. I think just because I appreciate, like, what people were able to do before special effects got as good as they are now. And I mean, yeah, like, the green screen stuff, some of it is a little, like, you can definitely tell, but it doesn't look as bad as I would have expected.
No, No, that, I mean, I will give it that credit is, yeah, some of the green screen was rough because you had like that black outline around things. But mm-hmm. yeah, but ultimately it wasn't too bad. Most of the effects were covered fairly well. Like the blimp, everything with the blimp looked pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And I think it's just, yeah, the story is just kind of basic, but I almost, it's like origin. You know what I mean? It's to me, it's like a travesty that they didn't get more movies.
Yeah, at least
because
one
I think
more.
I think there was so much room to grow.
Yeah.
Now that you have the characters established, and so I always hate that whenever people like really rag on, especially when it's like the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Because superhero movies, I feel like you just generally need time. You need the ability to like learn the character and learn the world and grow with it. And it's difficult to do that in one movie, but
yeah.
Anyways,
sometimes you need a whole Disney Plus series to give you an origin story of someone. Yeah, I'm looking at you, Falcon and Winter Soldier. Yep.
Yeah.
I think it would be neat if they could do something like that, or kind of how like they did Batman the animated series with I don't know if you guys watched that, but
which one?
I'm not really sure. The very first one, you know, that came out
the
like
Bruce Tim.
I've watched most of them, so I've probably seen that one particular. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, there was like kind of like a vaguely. I think even the lettering was fairly similar, like of the title, the sort of deco kind of style.
I definitely know which one you're talking about now. Yeah, because the Batmobile itself looked kind of like the Rocketeer.
Yeah, I mean, it was never really said that it was that Batman series took place in a bygone era, but then the styling of everything was very much kind of along those lines, even though there were computers and things like that, but the cars and the like the aesthetic and everything like that was kind of an art deco thing. So I could imagine, like, because that was one of the main criticisms that Disney had initially. They're like, people are not going to be interested in a movie from the 30s. I mean, even though Indiana Jones had done well, they're like, oh, no one's going to like it. So I don't know, like that particular, no one had a problem with the styling in that particular cartoon, I don't think. I don't know.
But that's the biggest charm of this, is the fact that it takes place before technology.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. But yeah, I give it a solid, I would put it in the 80s. Like, it's an 8 out of 10 movie to me.
Yeah, see, I was leaning the same way, where it's like, you know, critically, I can see that it's a little bit of a flimsy story. But like you already just mentioned, it's an origin story. So yeah, it's going to be a little bit lighter. And the fact that it's, you know, like I said at the top, it's just a MacGuffin story. I mean, it's not really about a guy going out to be a superhero. It's about this guy that found something and he wants to try it out. And now he's in the middle of all this hijinks of everyone looking for it. Like, it's just everybody wants the dingus. Yeah, that's all it is. Yeah, I think I could get behind an 80 to 85, somewhere in there, an 82% or something like this. It's, you know, basic story, but like I had fun, and the visuals were just so much fun to look at, and I just love anything about that era. You know, it just fun time to set a movie in.
I will say, if you enjoyed this film, it's a different era and everything like that, but it's also a fun film. It's just kind of hard to find. It's got like so many famous people in it. It's another film where Bill Campbell is the leading man, and he plays a very similar kind of like hapless character. It's called Out There.
Never heard of it.
It's from like the mid-90s. He plays like I think it's like a photojournalist who finds a camera that has like evidence of like supposedly like an alien invasion. And so it's just kind of like a fun, quirky movie with like a ton of cameos from like people that you'll recognize.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's his like leading lady, like the love interest in there have you ever seen the movie Interspace?
Oh yeah. Love Interspace.
The cashier with like the crazy hair in from that movie. And
yeah.
So it's just a fun one. It's a kind of like a similar kind of thing where a hapless guy finds a particular thing and then hijinks ensue.
Yeah.
Nice.
Right on. Well, there we go. That is The Rocketeer, and that's our show for this week. Oh, a big, huge thank you to our special guest, Josh Blum. Josh, if people want to find you out there doing your thing out on the old interwebs, give us your lowdown. Where can they find you?
Yeah, so I'm on most of the, you know, different social media platforms. If you go to Instagram, you can find me. You can just put in my name. You can find me under THE13THHR. and you'll find a link in the bio to all the different things. You can find me on the internet, or like, yeah, it's all the internet, I guess, but the website, I guess, you know, as 13thhr.wordpress.com. Or just use Google. Just put in my name in Google and put in 13th Hour Podcast. That's probably the easiest thing to do.
There you go. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I'm glad that we could bring you on for this movie, because, boy, you know, like, I have to say, I'm glad I enjoyed it, because I would have hated to sit here and just shit all over the movie that you love so fondly. But I think we've got three people that genuinely enjoyed this movie, and we're happy with this experience. So I'm glad that you could join us on this one.
Thank you for inviting me on. You know, it's really always fun, I think, to talk about this particular film. But I'm used to actually the opposite experience, where people are like, oh, I never heard of that movie. I haven't seen it. Oh, it's okay. Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's kind of, you know, whatever. And I'm like, you know, hey, give it another try. I'm already used to, like, you know, trying to cheerlead them on, and like, give it a shot, you know. So it's almost rare that I find people who like it.
Yeah, never even heard of it. That was my girlfriend just today. She said, what movie are you recording tonight? And I said, The Rocketeer. And she goes, what?
that's usual, I think.
So if you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is tell your friends, share our posts. Boy, word of mouth is the lifeblood of a podcast trying to get noticed. We're not Michelle Obama. We're not Hillary Clinton. We're not Joe Rogan. We're not Dax Shepard. We're not any of these famous people. We are just a couple of guys from Canada that want more people listening to us. So just tell people. We are thankful for every single one of you that listens to our show. Or if you want to go above and beyond and help us, go to whatever app it is you listen to your podcast on and give us 5 stars. It doesn't matter what you say in those reviews. It's not for our egos. I promise you, it's not for our egos. But it's those 5 stars and that review. They just drive you up the charts and they help you get noticed.
It's definitely for my ego.
Okay.
But also be sure to check out our website, www.iusedtolikethisone.com. There you can find links to all our podcast episodes as well as our social media. We have Facebook, we have Instagram, we have Twitter. If you want to get in touch with us, those are three very, very good options. But if you want a more personal touch, be sure to email us at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com. Drop us a line and let us know what movies you used to like, and then maybe you'll hear us talking about it on the show.
And Patreon is a thing. You know, it's a way to kind of help donate to people that put in all these hours and give you entertainment. You can become a producer of the show. You can get a shout out on the show. If you like Josh and you go listen to Josh's stuff, he's got a Patreon. It's one of these things that kind of helps monetize us. We are happy to put out the free content, but if you want to be a little bit more, be a producer, go to patreon.com/iusedtolikethisone and become part of our Patreon family. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band, Carter and the Capitals, anywhere you listen to music. Well, thank you for listening. And join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.
Go get 'em, boys.